You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk.
Family Matters.
18 minutes after 11 o'clock. It is a Monday, so it's time for Family Matters. Have we played this thing?
702 and Cape Talk.
Oh, you have?
Family Matters.
Oh, geez, okay. I'm getting old here. I'm not even listening to the wireless. I'm having so much fun with Dr. Motlana, who's back, the Deputy Chief Executive Officer of Sechaba Medical Solutions. Shari, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And you,
Sidis? Good. It's wonderful having you here. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, and welcome to, or morning to your listeners.
Indeed it is.
You see, both of us aren't on top of it this morning.
We're going to be talking today about suicide and about mental health in general and some of the stigma in relation to mental health, and then talk also about mental health services. So if you have a story, if you have a question for the doctor, please feel free to raise it. We'll do our best to help you. She obviously can't diagnose you quite literally on the telephone, but we really want to make this a safe space for you to ask questions in relation to mental health. So call us throughout the rest of this hour. 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg, and in Cape Town, 021-446-0567. Dr. Motlana, let's get straight into it, right? We've had a couple of prominent cases of South Africans that have died by suicide that have been discussed, that have shocked the nation over the last couple of weeks, couple of months. And it gives us an opportunity to take the pain and turn it into productive conversation about even preventative mental health medicine, which is something we don't normally speak about. The way people in my community, and let's keep the conversation honest to start out with, well, the whole time, the stigma in relation to suicide, there are views that the person was selfish, that if you commit suicide, and we even use a verb that suggests that there's some sort of agency involved, deliberate planning, you are seeking attention. People have some very weird ideas of how suicide may come about.
That's quite true, Eusebius, and I think it's important that we use this opportunity to really highlight the plight of those that suffer from mental illness and to talk about how we prevent it. And I think we do need to spend a little time talking about the language of suicide. To use the term commit suicide as steeped in our past history, where we understood suicide as something that was almost criminal, to commit a crime or by commission or omission, or in fact that it was a sin to commit a sin. And so the language around suicide insinuates that. And so whilst we use it in common parlance, I think we need to dig deeper and understand what it actually implies. And yes, it does tend to give the sense that suicide somehow, that individual has a sense of agency and they had a choice in the matter, and that it's something that it's frowned upon, which in fact causes the person who is feeling suicidal or has experience death by suicide. Now I have to watch my own language, because the literature in mental health, we
it's
speak about completed a suicide and attempted suicide, as though you know, if you attempt it, you haven't quite achieved a successful suicide. So even I need to watch my language, because unfortunately most of our literature in psychiatry still speaks of attempters and completers. And so we push away those who really need help because of our language. And we also stigmatize the survivors, the family and loved ones who then live on in such a way that they're unable to talk about the loss of their loved one for fear of shame and stigma.
So at the point at which someone makes a plan to take their own life, a lot in terms of their inner mental life would have played out already up until that point of their existence. And we often don't focus on that. And I sometimes think to myself, my God, you know, it's part of a healthy life that we go through ups and downs. We sometimes inappropriately, but we understand why, in colloquial language, appropriate the clinical language. And so, oh, I'm feeling so depressed today. But you don't actually mean clinical depression, right? Mm-hmm. So there are ups and downs that's healthy and part of the hurly-burly of life.
Yes.
But then I sometimes think to myself, I think of this auntie in my neighborhood who had locked herself up in the bathroom, and they got to her very late, and she'd poured, I think it was either spirit or something over her, methylated spirit, and set herself alight. By the time they retrieved her, a couple of hours later, she was unfortunately dead. And I think to myself, imagine being, and I can't imagine because I'm not in that space, but what it must take psychologically to be in such a place that you are standing upright and you have set yourself alight because you that is the final symptom of what must have happened before. Yes. And then I think to myself, just as an average Joe, this must have been someone who clearly had undiagnosed mental illness, because no one endures that level of pain almost stoically as you are dying by suicide.
Yes, Eusebius, it's in fact very sad. One must imagine that the primal instinct of all human beings is survival. So we are all driven by survival even before we even think it. You know, try to hold your breath. You're going to gasp for another breath, right?
Yeah.
So, and that is what drives us. So at the point at which a human being believes that it's better not to be alive and that their pain and suffering is so that they cannot bear another day, one must understand that this is a very painful choice. And, you know, in my clinical practice where I've worked with patients where we've tried one drug regimen after another without success, and that individual is in and out of hospital and they despair. And sometimes we too, as mental health practitioners, despair because we know that we are, at least psychiatry is an evolving science. We know so little about depression. We know that it's a mixture of genetics, of environment, and they all conspire to make us ill. We do have treatments, but for the most part, sometimes they're inadequate. There is some success, you know, I don't want to be bleak.
Sure.
There are those that do respond, but they are for some people, like in any other physical illness, like, you know, for example, if you've got a malignancy, a cancer, some people respond to treatment and others don't. And for those who don't respond, it's oftentimes that they feel that they cannot go on. And yes, it's hard for us to imagine when we're not in that position what it must be like. But I must say the pain and suffering patients endure, one has to understand that it is becomes unbearable. The depression they face, that, you know, every decision they make is painful, to get up in the morning, to eat, to look after themselves, to even be in a relationship, to plan for the future. They lose hope. Often they isolated, use substances, and the tragedy is that if they're not picked up early enough, they may commit suicide without ever knowing, or their family and loved ones ever knowing that they were suffering. And for those who do get treatment, I think as mental health practitioners, we often have to accept that we're not always successful in treating all our patients.
Do we know, Dr. Motlane, specifically in the South African context, in our society, are there any data or interesting patterns, alternatively, in your professional experience, of the sources of trauma and other life experiences that can lead to someone becoming suicidal? Because I think to myself, and I want to link it to the other reason why we have set up today's conversation, which is not just suicide, but mental health in general and stigma related to mental health services. I think to myself, my God, if you're a South African, you don't only need unique facts about your individual life that can potentially make you depressed, clinically depressed, suicidal. There are also realities about our society at large. We are drenched in violence. There's crime. You could have been a hijacked victim. You could have been raped. You could have been bullied, because those things are so rife in our society. You could have a mental health crisis that is set off by the fact that you are poor or unemployed and you feel emasculated in a society that tells you, as a man, you should provide. Shadi's going to work, but you sitting at home. It seems like we are a society that is ripe for mental health crises, and yet we don't talk about it. Yes. We don't talk about it, and we treat it as, oh, wow, Eusebius committed suicide, we will say. But even then, the moment will pass for 2 or 3 weeks of the news cycle, and there isn't a societal spotlight that maybe there are tens of thousands of people, given the facts of our society, that are as susceptible to this as conditions like diabetes, for example?
Eusebius, I think you've touched on something, and I'd like to take us even further back and talk about apartheid and the trauma that South Africans have been subjected to. Those that were in the country lived through state of emergencies, harassment, being picked up, you know, for not having a pass. These, it becomes transgenerational. Mm. Let's talk about the exiles, ANC leaders that were in camps and the traumas they were subjected to, being under constant surveillance. Let's talk about what happened to young white men who are conscripts, who have served on the border. Mm. And then we wonder why there's road rage. We've never actually really healed the wounds of what we've been subjected to during apartheid and, you know, who's responsible for what part our suffering and kind of national healing. Mm. And so when things erupt where the incidents of the K word, it inflames all that anger and resentment and brings back all that trauma that we all carry within us, a collective trauma, which plays out in the way in which gender relations play out in this country, how men treat women and the violence against women, the crime in this country where it feels that we're not protected and vulnerable. And yes, all of these are cause for concern. And if you look at how mental health care services in terms of the budget that's allocated to it, it signifies the public stigma. You know, I remember when I was working in for Gauteng Health, and I highlighted the fact that we didn't get sufficient budget for the services that we had to provide. And I was told, well, people don't die, you know, for other non-communicable diseases, there's death, there's diabetes, people die. Some for mental health, they don't. Wow. And then Life as a Dimeni happened. And, you know, for a little while, mental health goes into the spotlight, but it's not sustained until the next disaster happens. Right. And so we limp and hobble from one disaster to another. And I'm hoping that, you know, the kind of conversations we're starting to have will lead to real change, where mental health becomes something is a topic. We know that the WHO says it will be one of the most debilitating illnesses by 2030. And yet even in the private sector, which we haven't even touched on, where the medical aid too discriminates against those with mental health. So you don't get the same kind of cover for mental illness as you do for general medical illnesses. And medical aids are saying, well, whoa, you know, we're watching all the spend on mental health. We're wondering if the doctors are just making up these diseases.
Treating it as if it's
cosmetic. Why are we
thinking
we're going to buck the trend when the rest of the world is experiencing increasing rates of mental health problems.
Yeah.
So why is it that we think we're going to be different? Why don't we want to spend on mental health?
Yeah. Well, give us a call, 011-883-0702. This is a safe space. You can ask whatever question you want. We're focusing on suicide and mental health in general, and perhaps the doctor can help you, or where we can't, we'll do our best to also give you services that you might be able to check out. Cape Town, 021-446-0567. If you do want to share your story with us, or ask a question, and perhaps you're not ready to be engaged, that's okay too. Give us a voice note. You can leave it on the number 072-702-1702.
702 and Cape Talk.
Family Matters.
23 minutes before noon. Kathy, thank you so much for calling in today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for taking my call. I've pulled off the road. I'm busy driving into Cape Town, and I wanted to share something that I have found over the last 13 years since my only child committed suicide. Mm. She was 17 years old. She was in matric, and she stayed home sick from school the one morning, saying that she really didn't feel well. And we lived on a farm, and I went off to do the work around the farm and came back, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and she had found the keys to the safe, and she shot herself in the head.
Sure.
What I want to share with you about this is that I have found over the last many years, with lots of retrospect thinking and reading and watching and listening, and I just want to share, and maybe other parents of teenagers specifically might find that they feel the same. My daughter was a high achiever at school academically, and she was quite a private girl. Certainly, we need to remember that with a teenage brain, it is more often that they have a moment where they just say, I just can't do anymore. I can't deal with the consequences of what's just happened in my life, and I'm going. And it's a moment of madness with not really understanding the consequences, as opposed to a long-treated depression or untreated depression. And you very seldom get people understanding that. They will immediately say to you, didn't you know she was depressed?
Yeah.
And that's just a thought that I wanted to put there.
Kathy, can I just ask you this question? I want to honor your courage to share your story with us. For other parents out there that grapple, you know, not everyone who dies by suicide has an obvious history, obvious reasons, or leave a suicide note or to explain themselves. How did you, as Kathy and the rest of the family, begin a healing process, if you have managed to do so? Because I know so many people who judge themselves, who think, I should have known better, why didn't I pick up on the symptoms, who rummage through the bedroom to try and find maybe a note, and that they don't happen upon one. How have you dealt with that as a family?
I think, first of all, my daughter left a very hurried scribble note.
Okay.
And asked us to not accept blame. Obviously, that doesn't quite work like that. And it certainly took a long time to get out of your pajamas and get dressed and get up every morning. Especially, you know, as an only child, there was no purpose to get up ourselves. However, I think that you go through the years of, if only I didn't I see it? And you see, this I still, even now, 13 years later, pull a book off a bookshelf and think, oh, maybe there's something of hers in this book. So that sort of question mark is with you. And I don't think you ever recover from loss of a child. A loss of a child via suicide, I think what you do is you learn to live graciously with by the side, and it'll always be there. So once you accept that, then you can try and move forward.
Yeah.
Not get over anything, but move forward with it.
Thank you, Kathy. Kathy obviously raises a number of issues there that we should touch on, and then we'll come to your call, Buyisiwe, Gugu, and Mark as well right after that. Is it possible to know whether you have a friend, a colleague, a loved one who may be experiencing mental illness? So that's one piece. And then the other is, taking care of my own mental health as someone that might have lost someone to a mental illness, because presumably with self-blame comes an opportunity for me myself to be triggered.
Thanks, Eusebius. I think, yes, it's important for us to understand that the survivors of depression often qualitatively have a really, really difficult time overcoming the suicide, and primarily because there's a lot of guilt and blame. Exactly as Kathy says, trying to say, you know, is there a note? In the minority of cases, there's a note. And even if there is a note, the substance of it is usually not that useful. And is there a chance that you could have known, as you asked in the first part of the question? I think it's important also to understand that depression isn't the only cause of suicide and mental health. A variety of other conditions could also result in suicide. For example, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, anorexia nervosa, probably the highest death rate. It's not an intentional suicide, but that's the end result, you know, because the restriction of food, and the end result is death. So for a number of reasons, and not everyone who commits suicide is depressed. People may have another reason for suicide, which may be out of shame, and it's an impulsive act at that time.
Sure.
And others, you know, we know about the suicide bombers. So just to complete the picture on suicide. And in adolescence, I wouldn't say it's a momentary act or incident of madness or psychosis, as Kathy described it, but to understand that the adolescent brain, yes, is in development. And at that stage, there's also a lot of hormonal changes. But most importantly, the adolescent is less likely than an adult to be able to cope emotionally and cognitively with some of the challenges. They don't have some of those coping mechanisms that you develop over time. And certainly suicide in adolescence is actually one of the killers in mental health. And we regard suicide in adolescence very seriously. Mm-hmm. And just to say that depression occurs in children, and even in children as young as six, we've seen suicide attempts and suicide ideation. And so one must not underestimate the ability of children to feel depressed. And in fact, children, when they do manifest with psychiatric illnesses, these illnesses tend to be more severe because of the genetic loading, as you can imagine. The earlier, you know, I also make a similarity to malignancies. The earlier certain malignancy manifests is actually signifies the genetic loading.
Okay.
And so, yes, depression in children is very much a phenomenon that we are aware of and do take seriously.
Buyisiwe, good morning.
Good morning, Sibus. Can I ask a question to Dr. Motlane?
Yes, go ahead. The doctor's listening.
What I want
listening.
To find out, my daughter, she's 18 years. She cut herself 2 months ago. Her father committed suicide when she was 2 years old. Now, is it genetic? Because now I'm towing. I asked the clinical psychologist at school to talk to her because everyone, when I phoned, they said to me, she has to be the one who asked for help. Now, I don't know what to do because she's in boarding school. When she came back, I said to her, look at your hands, what you've done to yourself. What do I do? When you're dead, what's going to happen to me? You know, I don't know where, how far would I go with my reprimanding of what she did. But then, is it a genetic health thing that it runs through her blood? I don't know. She's very skinny. You have to beg her to eat. And she's writing a matric this year.
Certainly, I would say that your daughter's cutting herself is a cry for help, and that often cutters would say that they cut themselves because the physical pain is more bearable than the emotional pain. I do think that this is an opportunity for you and the clinical psychologist, or if you can get Ropin, a psychiatrist, to work with her, because as you said, she's also in her matric year, and we need to attend to what the underlying issues are. I can't say at face value whether this is the same disorder as her father had, but certainly we know that the development of depression is higher. You have a higher risk if you lose a parent before the age of 11, so certainly she's at risk. And I think this is a real opportunity to work with her and try and get her treated appropriately.
Thank you very much.
Okay. But you see, where have you got access to such services? Have you actually tried to access services either in the public or the private sector?
I won't be able to access it. It's only that I didn't know where to go, because when the lady at school who heads the thing at school was talking to her, then she will phone me and said, no, we had a session today. She was able to talk to me. Yes, with the challenges, because she failed grade 11 and then she had to do it again. But this time she's not willing to fail grade 12. Now, is it too much work to do? You know, it's then if I need to go further to get assistance, I'll be able to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Buyisiwe. All the best to you and to your family. Gugu, good morning.
Hi, CVS. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, Gugu. Thank you for holding on.
Thank you. My question is pretty simple. We had my cousin who's 21 years old commit suicide about a month ago. For us, he seemed pretty normal. Everything was normal. We didn't see any signs that maybe he could have been ill, to the point his girlfriend didn't even think that he was either depressed or something was upsetting him. It was just such a shock to the family, and I think what we're finding difficult is to move forward from there, because he looked normal.
And there was no note, okay. There was nothing, no explanation.
There's no explanation. In fact, the day he took his own life, he had planned an event to reunite with his friends, and he invited everybody to dinner that he just didn't pitch at.
Okay, Gugu, very important question that Gugu is raising, because, and I want to take a break here. Sometimes, you know, the experts that we've had in the show, and we have amazing experts, we don't necessarily talk about mental health. but about teenagers and raising teenagers. And there are two bits of advice they always give that now drummed into my head as the broadcaster, to keep open the communications channel with young adults and with young people so that there's a better chance of them speaking out than not. And of course, the other is to look for deviations in the patterns of behavior, something out of the ordinary as well. But Gugu raises the question of whether mental health is always symptomatic. And I'm going to ask Dr. Motlana to address that on the other side of this.
702 and Cape Talk.
Family Matters.
Are we focusing on suicide, but more broadly mental health today with Dr. Mashadi Motlana? Doctor, let's talk about that last call, which was really, really interesting. There aren't always symptoms that someone may be battling mental health.
That's correct. So there are a few common fallacies. One is some people believe that if someone is about to take their lives, that they're not going to say it. but in fact, they do. And so please don't ignore those that do say. And the second part is because of the stigma and people often self-stigmatize, so they are so afraid of coming out and saying that they're suicidal that they may not say. The fact that Gugu talks about her cousin having wanted to get everyone together might actually have been intentional. Maybe the timing went awry, but it might have been an opportunity for that individual, in fact, to say goodbye to everybody before taking their lives. So that might have also have been a deviation from the things they normally do. But the common signs of isolating themselves, change in behavior where they enjoyed certain things, they're no longer doing that, sudden substance abuse or increased substance abuse, those signs may be present or not. And so it can be extremely difficult. But what Eusebius touched upon is, opening up spaces in our community, in our homes and the workplace for us to have honest conversations about what we're going through, to be able to talk about the difficulties, to talk about suicide and not committing suicide, and to understand that the stigma around mental health cuts across race, cuts across culture, that we all struggle with it. There usually aren't safe spaces, especially in the workplace, for people to even start to talk about their mental illness. Individuals understand that that may be career limiting. Oftentimes I've sat on boards of companies that have struggled to find EE scores for disability. But if they really looked a little deeper, they'd find that a significant proportion of their workforce actually have a mental illness of some kind, are on treatment, and they haven't provided a safe space for those individuals to be able to say they're ill, that they suffer from disability, that give them the opportunity to go for their follow-ups, get treated. And in fact, without that kind of support, we often find a revolving door for mental illness where people are admitted almost annually, but there's hardly any follow-up with the end result that they become more and more ill and dysfunctional.
Absolutely. And I'm going to come back to that stigma in a second. I just wanted to know from you practically, what should I do, or what is your advice if I see someone looks like they might have been cutting themselves, or someone talks about the fact that they're thinking suicidal thoughts? Because very often, if we keep it real, our responses are unhelpful. We'll say things like, "Ah, man, Shadi was just looking for attention. If she really wanted to do it, if she wanted to kill herself, she would have. Why did she only take 10 tablets? Mm-hmm. She knows how to do it. She's just looking for attention." Yes. That's how we speak when someone takes some steps not to completion around taking their life. And then we continue to say, they're not really serious. Ignore them. Yes. If they're serious, they would have done it successfully.
Yes. So the lethality of the method of suicide often creates another fallacy that, if you're just a cutter, you're definitely, you're not brave enough, or you're not really suicidal, you're just attention seeking. Mm. And what we do know about people who do die by suicide is that preceding that, there were many cutting attempts, or non-lethal attempts. And sometimes people don't actually understand whether their method of use is lethal or not, which is why they survive. And so we should not underestimate eliminate that. One of the things we look out for is their levels of anger that their method was not successful. That's usually a real indication that their intentions were serious. But if someone's cutting themselves, it's definitely a signal that they're not well. And we need to take that opportunity to help them and look at the underlying causes. What's of concern also is that, you know, we always look for other people to blame and not recognize that people with mental health issues, it is an illness that requires treatment. Yes, there may be a number of social, political factors around that. And, you know, it's no use only looking at that because, yes, we know the environment plays a huge part. But I wouldn't like for people that are suicidal to believe that the illness in and of itself isn't sufficient for them to be suicidal. It doesn't have to be that, you know, you're the dean of a medical school where there were a whole lot of political forces around you that contributed to your mental illness. We have to make it safe for all people with mental illness to be able to say, I'm struggling, and to ask for help.
Doctor, now, yes, the nub of the practical systemic challenge in our society, and I know you feel very passionate about this. When you say, if that person is clearly signaling to us that they need help, we need to help them. But what does it mean to help them? Because I assume that for the average person who cannot access private health care, you can't just rock up at, maybe I'm wrong, at a public hospital or clinic and say, I'm not here with a physical problem, nurse, but I have had suicidal thoughts. You're probably like, Suka, wait a minute. Abortion, anyone? You know what I mean? So, like, what does it mean to access these services? Yes. And then in the private sector, many of us, despite being on expensive discovery and other programs, end up having to pay out of pocket, and it becomes sometimes even prohibitively expensive for those people who are working class South Africans.
Yes.
On medical aid, even.
I completely understand what you're saying. And in fact, so I'm going to start with the first part. One of the things that suicidal people often face is that they do access emergency services, and the experiences are that they face stigma from the very people that they're expecting help from, so the healthcare workers. When you immediately get labeled as a possible psychiatric patient, you know, you're sidelined. And those that have presented with suicidality often felt that they weren't attended to or taken seriously. So access to psychiatrists is quite difficult in the public sector because they're few. But there are nurses, psychiatric trained nurses in the clinics that you can access at a local clinic. And then to be usually the person is that you interviewed by the nurse, and they would then refer you on to a medical practitioner. If there's a registrar available, some of the psychiatric services in the community are covered by a registrar who's under supervision by a consultant. So registrar, it would be a psychiatrist in training, and then a psychiatrist might be available that's in proximity to a tertiary institution. But these, what I'm describing is a setup that's usually only in cities. In the rural areas, the situation is far more difficult. And if you look at research about access to mental health care services, people will tell you that amongst Africans, they're more likely to see traditional healers than psychiatrists. But really, I think it's a reflection of the lack of access to care. Mm-hmm. And there's a real problem accessing mental health services, particularly in rural areas, and even getting medication. And often when we discharge patients from tertiary institutions into rural sectors, into rural communities, we find that patients relapse because they're inconsistent medication supply. So you're quite right that we really, and this is again highlighting what I spoke about, you know, there'll be a crisis in a hospital, in an institution where we all rally and say, you know, mental health is real and we need to provide resources. And a few weeks after, it's all quiet and forgotten. We put a Band-Aid over the problem.
Yeah.
And we continue to have life as idemenes, as I call it, happening daily in this country because our public health services are inadequate.
We've got a minute left. I wonder whether we can take it that opportunity to slay a myth that you've already slayed, but I want to underscore it. And you and I spoke about it during one of the spot breaks. How important is it for the public to really take seriously the fact that when it comes to mental ill health, suicide, that it is colorblind, genderblind, classblind, and geography blind?
Yes. So for each community, it's quite curious. Everyone believes that in their particular cultural group, mental health is particularly stigmatized. In the literature that is mainly Western, there's a view that perhaps mental illness is actually more acceptable in Asian and African communities. However, it's only because the research is usually not conducted in those communities. And in fact, the stigma is possibly as high. With increases in mental health literacy, we've seen some improvement in terms of stigma. But I think that, you know, at the core of mental illness and the stigma therein is the inability of humans to accept that there's a part of them, their intellect, their ability to think, their self can be affected. And so mental illness becomes something that, despite all the programs, you know, we still battle with in overcoming stigmatizing attitudes, whether 100%. They're public or self-stigma.
Yeah, a couple of numbers in case you need them and you're listening to the show. Between 8 in the morning and in the evening, Mondays to Sunday, a number you can call if you need a counselor, 011-234-4837. If you have a suicidal emergency and you'd like to talk through that, you can contact 0800-567-567 or the 24-hour helpline, 0800-12-13-14. Dr. Matlana, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. You see this.